Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I was born in a country town, Cooma, just at the foot of the Snowy Mountains. And I moved from there to Norfolk Island and then to Sydney when I was about seven. So I'd moved around a lot as a kid and had a strong sense of family because we were always together. But also, certainly, I came to realise very young that people didn't see Aboriginality as a positive thing. And, and obviously that was quite true through most of my life. Even as a young adult, I was asked what nationality I was and I said Aboriginal very proudly. And the person said, "Don't worry, you can't tell."
Professor Larissa Berendt is a Uluru and Gamilaroi woman. She's a lawyer, writer, filmmaker and broadcaster who has often found herself at the intersection of feminism and race issues.
There are still times where you see a blindness and, I remember when the Mabo case came down and the women's electoral lobby said that they wouldn't have a position on Mabo because it wasn't a feminist issue. And a few of us took issue with them about it and said, well, Aboriginal women lose their land at a greater rate than Aboriginal men. Anthropologists who came out and mapped all these places were men, always assumed men were in charge, recorded men's history and not women's history. So it's actually harder for women to make claims based on historical archive, and we have lost our cultural heritage and our sites at a much higher rate. There is no way you could say that native title is not a feminist issue. And once they were confronted with that point of view, they did change their position on that. So, I think sometimes you still see a bit of a blind spot around that. But my sense is once you start to have the conversation, both sides become empowered by that.
This is Witch Hunt. I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and we're looking at what comes after Me Too. There are many times through history where feminism has been accused of being a movement for the benefit of white, middle and upper class women. Larissa's example shows that this can be true, that sometimes a movement can leave its most vulnerable members behind. Examining how different types of disadvantage overlap is often called the study of intersectionality. Today, we've brought together three women whose backgrounds complicate their relationship with Me Too. You've already met Larissa. We're also speaking to Ruby Hamad, a writer.
I generally write about, I guess, what you would call social justice issues, racism, feminism, and my research is on, my PhD research is on media coverage of the Middle East.
And Jordan Raskopoulos.
I'm a comedian, entertainer, YouTube celebrity, and other. Transgender woman, that's relevant to this conversation, yeah.
And front woman of Axis of Awesome. So what does intersectionality mean to them?
Well, look, I mean, I guess there's a simple explanation, there's a complex explanation. And I guess, when we sort of think about it in terms of how we write about it and feminist analysis or Indigenous affairs, it's always about where you would have otherness that is of different types. So you're not in the dominant mould, so Indigenous women, gay men, all of that sort of thing, where you've got more than one identity that would be competing in a space. So for myself as an Indigenous woman, I guess it's about where in my experience I'm asked to kind of separate who I am into compartments that fit other people's ideas of what identity is. I mean, I don't think of myself in terms of parts of me. I'm just who I am. But I think for those of us who find ourselves in these intersections, it's because we don't fit the dominant narrative and we're being asked to pull ourselves apart to try and fit into the boxes that you'd tick on a census form.
Oh, it's a really great way of articulating that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's about recognising that systems of power and systems of marginalisation are linked, that they don't exist separate to one another, and that they can counteract each other and they can reinforce each other. And it's about recognising that, and it's all fluid, and that it's essentially a whole bunch of strings strung together across a room, you know, and if you pull on one, it affects others and it makes some stronger and it makes some weaker. And it's about recognizing that and being open to the dialogue of how systems of power and marginalization interact.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note where, you know, the term came from. So before the you know, the term intersectionality was coined, the concept was already there, or this idea that oppression doesn't hit certain people from only one angle. And like, you know, many social justice movements, it started with black women and black women in America. And it was because, you know, they couldn't separate their blackness from their woman, from being women, they were hit by oppression specifically as black women in a way that black men weren't and white women weren't. So the racism and the sexism together to form, you know, a new kind of unique oppression. And that is when, you know, in the late 80s is Kimberly Crenshaw coined that term intersectionality to explain that, you know, in terms of, you know, like a traffic intersection where you've got racism coming this way and sexism coming this way and they collide and then there's that black woman right there. And that you can't address her way of you know, of moving and navigating in this world without addressing both her race and her sex. And then, of course, it you know, with Crenshaw's blessing and encouragement, it got, you know, used in different contexts. Mm. So, you know, with trans women and other women of colour who weren't black and disabled women and sex workers, et cetera. So that's where it comes from. And I think it's also really important to recognise that, you know, It's what is intersecting is not the people, it's the oppressions. Yeah. And I think when we remember, you know, when we recognize that and put that at the forefront, it brings us back to this issue of addressing the structure, yes, not just the individual. So look, we are obviously affected by these discriminations as individuals, but we're targeted as members of a group. Mm. And I think it's important, yeah, to note.
And power is intersectional as well. Yep. That power becomes stronger when it intersects with other power. I think that's
really right. I think people sort of think, oh, you're an Aboriginal woman, so you must get the discrimination from being Aboriginal and then the sexism from being a woman, as though that's how you exist in your life. And the concept that actually there is a discrimination by virtue of just being an Aboriginal woman, I think is really hard for people who don't think about how intersectionality plays out in lived experience. It goes back to your point, I think, Jordan, of how important it is to tell stories, which was a very, very early part of the first wave feminism, was about just telling a story, talking your truth. I mean, if there's one thing that I think still carries the transformation role of feminism through that still makes it relevant, it is that thing about unless you hear the story of an individual, the power of a person's personal story, their personal narrative is actually the point of transformation. Yeah.
I was born in Lebanon. My parents came here when I was two. They were fleeing the Lebanese civil war It was definitely a struggle for the whole family coming here. You know, my parents had six children at that time, and they were working in, both of them worked in a plastics factory, actually, in St. Peter's. And I was always aware of difference, of being different. And you come to realise you're never really fully one or the other, I guess. That's what it comes down to. Never, as much as I kind of grew up here and, you know, I'm more comfortable speaking English than I am now speaking Arabic. So I'm obviously a product of that, but I'm also still a product of my family's culture and background, and that's something that I've become increasingly more proud of and more kind of just not willing to tolerate any sort of being shamed for that. An example of sexism and racism, you know, intersecting to affect Arab and or, you know, Muslim women is a lot of the abuse that I'll get from men online is unique to being from a Muslim female background. So I'll get caught, I'll get called things like a, you know, a Hezbollah whore or, you know, an ISIS slut. I'll get men telling me, you know, do you have a clitoris? Let me see it, because of the whole, you know, this idea that you know, FGM is this sort of this mandatory thing amongst all Muslim, you know, cultures, which is completely untrue, and you know, won't really get into to that. But yeah, so these are, it is sexism and racism in a way that is only experienced by women from that particular background. So that it's almost like they find that way to. So it happens, yeah. You know, with an Aboriginal woman and trans women, and you know, and even like, you know, trans women of color. Like,
yeah.
There's something about being a woman of color and being a trans woman of color together that the violence and hatred just skyrockets. You know, and which is you're already exposed to so much violence as a trans woman and as a woman and as a black person, and then you combine all those together, and then. You know, what's the life expectancy of a woman, a trans woman of colour in the, I don't know if Australia has those statistics, but in the US it's like 35.
Yeah. I think it's in South America, so Brazil. Yes,
Brazil's another one where it's shocking, and it's in the low, imagine your life expectancy, you know, and then, you know, the same as with, you know, in Indigenous women, Indigenous men, the life expectancy is, it's so low because of those intersections of oppression, and that's really that's you know, that's what we have to get across, that it's not just, oh, I'm, you know, oppressed because I'm a woman and I'm Arab, and you just put these together, and it's not. It's a very unique, and it's a way of undermining your entire value and your being as a person. Like it's a way of just essentially saying you're useless on many and valueless on many different levels, and there's no point in you even, you know, trying. And that's what it's about. It's about trying to get, you know, your morale so low, because it's like, well, how do you overcome, you know, this? You're always reduced to these things.
And it is exhausting.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm always trained now these days. It's like,
That's like my experience three years ago before transition was that if I was exhausted, it was from my work. And if I'm exhausted, it's because I'm dealing with assholes, you know? Yeah. And it's just, and it's at the point now where, it's just, I was, you know, when I started transition, I was so eager, you know, get my hands in and make a difference. And now I'm so bloody tired, and I've only had to suffer for the 3 years, you know? I think, I mean, I was definitely aware that things would change, and I was definitely aware how things would change, but not really aware of how that would affect me and how that would feel. And I think when speaking to men who have an idea of, you know, women's experiences, they don't have the experience, you know. And I think the big, big thing that surprised me was constancy. You know, I knew that it was difficult for women to walk alone at night, but I didn't really understand that you would be afraid constantly, you know, that fear would be with you every night or whenever you are alone or when, you know, that that is what surprised me, constancy.
Do you think that men understand that?
You know, a lot of guys, I'll talk about an experience. So pretty early on in my transition, so shortly after coming out publicly, we did a show in New Zealand. And after the gig, I went to the bathroom and a dude followed me into the bathroom. And while I was in the toilet, started yelling at me through the door that I didn't belong there. And just because you're in a dress doesn't make you a woman. And then he just started peeing on the floor. And it was really, really messed up. Like that's, and I was pretty shook by that. And when I spoke to the boys in my band, their response was, "Oh my God, that's so weird. That is so weird and crazy." And, you know, and there was a lot of compassion there and they supported me. But when I spoke to women in my life, there was an understanding and there was a similar experience, you know. And I think that's the thing, is that men do experience instances of harassment or fear, or but they're weird. They're extraordinary, you know, whereas for women, they are ordinary. And I think that's the thing about the Me Too movement, was just to say, actually, these experiences are common amongst women. And it's a shared experience. You know, the fact that I could talk about this, about being followed by a man and harassed in a bathroom, and speaking to other women, could come back and say, "Oh yeah, I've had something similar."
What something I've been feeling very recently is if there's anything worse than the feeling of being reduced to your, you know, your racial background or your, or some aspect of your identity, is to be erased from it. And that's something that I, like, you know, I said I've been having recently in conversations around Syria. So at the same time, all these years where I've been writing about being, you know, racism and being Arab and being from a Muslim background, and being attacked on those lines, you know, along racial and Islamophobic lines. Now that I'm finding, as I've started to speak out a little more about, you know, my views on Syria, and just kind of getting shot down and saying, "Well, you're not really Syrian anyway, you live here." It's like, wait a minute. So like all this time I've been told, "Well, I'm not really Australian, I'm Arab, go back to where you come from." And now that I'm trying to sort of, you know, tell you, you know, if you like, educate you, and I was trying to, in a respectful way, about what it's like, you know, to be from that part of the world and hearing all these things being said and that you know are not true, and trying to address them, and then to then be told, "Well, that's not really you anyway." It's like, so after all these years I've been reduced to my Arabness, I'm now being erased from it. And it's like, what?
And it is interesting, like you do get that very directed violence. It's at your unique identity. But I think even the act of trying to get you to unpack that is an act of violence, to try and get you to split who you are into compartments, is actually a way of doing the same thing, of kind of chipping away at your confidence, breaking down your strength and your resilience.
And I think there's a big thing about building pride in your difference as well. And I mean, obviously pride is a big word in the LGBT plus community. And that's because pride is the opposite of shame, and that we live in a society that encourages us to feel ashamed of who we are. And that what intersects those letters, and I feel like, you know, intersects a lot of marginalized people, is this sense that society is encouraging us to feel ashamed about these aspects of ourselves. And the yielding that the society is doing is yielding to the point of acceptance. You know, all right, well, we will accept that you're different. We accept that you're different. Whereas we need to push past that towards pride. We need for ourselves, and we need for our society to be proud of our difference, because it's cool and it's interesting. You know, and as a transgender person, there is a sense, even amongst the trans community, for a lot of people, that they don't want to be trans. You know, they want to be cisgender. You know, that their transness is the source of so much of their discomfort, and, you know, that they perceive their transness as a source of their discomfort and their oppression. And if they were born cis, their life would be better. And it would, but not in the sense of that it didn't come from them being trans, it became from society treating them poorly. And the thing is, I like being transgender. I like it. It's me. I would be a completely different person if I was born differently. I'd be a completely different person if I transitioned at a different point in my life. I like my life. I like who I am. I think I am interesting and I am cool. And I think my transness is intrinsic to that. And I want to talk about it and I want you to talk about it with me. And it's okay that we're different because it's interesting when people are different.
So I'm, you know, here a straight white woman. I know it's not your responsibility to tell me what I should do better, but what advice would you give to me?
I mean, it's hard to sort of give this blanket advice, but it's in every, you know, there are different responses that we need. I was about to say require. That's not quite the right word, but we need. Like, we need that understanding from different, you know, in different contexts. But I guess a lot, you know, the first thing would be the same as what's underlying the whole Me Too movement, which is, you know, believe us. If a woman of colour or a trans woman, disabled woman is saying what the way you're talking, the way you're acting right now is hurting me, it's a form of violence, I know you can't see it because you're on that side and I'm here, but, you know, understand that I'm not telling you this to make you feel bad.
I think that's really strong, good advice. And in a way it is about that, the listening part. And I guess one of the things that I think is a good example of that is people will often ring me and say, you know, we're doing this thing on domestic violence or we're doing this thing on discrimination in the workplace. Do you have any Aboriginal women who can come along and help us with what we want to do? You know, we want to be inclusive, so have you got an Aboriginal person who can come along and join what we're doing? And it just seems to me like that is fundamentally the wrong way to start. If somebody takes your advice, they would be actually saying, what is it that you want from us? Like, how can we help you? And that's, I think, a really fundamental shift. But I also think Jordan makes a really good comment too. It always reminds me of something that Jane Caro says when she's often smacked down for being a middle-class white woman. And she said, well, if I don't speak out, of all the people who have the opportunity to say something, surely it's me. I should be the first out there. And I think there is something about finding that line between really listening, yeah, really listening, and then actually taking up your responsibility.
And I guess so what I'm hearing is kind of one of the fundamental things of Me Too was believe women. And so that goes for everyone.
Yeah.
If you're being told you're silencing me, you're not listening to me, believe the person who's telling you. And also listen to other, make your responsibility to find other people's stories and to listen to them.
And tell your story of change. Tell your story of how someone said something to you and it got through and it changed you, you know. And celebrate that, like celebrate change. You know, I think we're critical of people who have changed. Oh, you were never always that way. You know, I think when we, you know, talked about the yes vote and we were critical of politicians who would have voted no 5 years ago. And why are we critical of people changing? That's what we want.
I agree that it would be great if we could celebrate change, but we seem to be going backwards in terms of our polarisation in politics and what side of politics we belong to. Identity politics is a classic example. The left and the right accuse each other of making everything about identity at the detriment of real and substantial change. How do we push through that?
It's really hard, but it's not impossible. I think it is about recognizing various systems of oppression, you know, and I think one thing that we don't talk enough about, well, no, I'll rephrase that. One thing that is difficult to talk about, but class, I'm talking about class, right? I think we live in a time where we find it very difficult to talk about class. And there is an appearance that activism seems to be directed towards cisgender white men. And we forget or we fail to convey, I think we recognise it, but we fail to convey class and wealth and all those things, and that the intersections of class are often left out of discussions. And so working class people do feel ostracised from the left and from activism and feel that activists don't fight for them. And I think we need to bring class into that discussion And that brings other people in. Once we talk about the way in which wealth and power oppresses alongside, you know, race and gender and age and disability, you know, we bring all of that into the discussion, then I think we can breed a sense of empathy. And we can also get to help people recognize their own problems again. I think one of the awful things about our society is that the working class have been convinced that they're not oppressed and that wealth is attributed to hard work. And so, you know, the idea that the wealthy are wealthy because they've worked the hardest is believed. And that is, what a swindle. You know, what a swindle. And that there is a kinship of shared whiteness between, you know, the white working class and the powerful people of the world, the wealthy people of the world, and that they have tapped into that kinship of shared whiteness and redirected their fury. You know, these people are furious that they're poor and they're furious that they don't have jobs, and they've redirected that fury towards marginalized people. You know, the white working class believes that they are poor and unhappy because of migrants stealing their jobs or black people terrorizing their neighborhoods. And it's outrageous that that's the case, you know. But at the same time, we are saying in our rhetoric and our dialogue that you are people of privilege, because their perception of what we are saying is that white men are the problem and white men are people of privilege, of ultimate privilege. And they are saying, how can I be privileged if I am poor and I am unhappy?
Please subscribe to Witch Hunt wherever you listen to your podcasts and leave us a rating or review if you can. You can also find us on theguardian.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.